Tonight, I'm pleased to welcome a cycling friend, Scott Mercier, who gave up a pro career when he felt the expectations of performance enhancement were too much, and a two-time national champion, Ian McGregor, a pro who found a way to compete clean. We'll talk about what that looks like on a cycling team, and last but not least, on the telephone with us from Aspen, Lance Armstrong. A note of personal involvement, I was and continue to be a financial supporter of cycling teams. I was drawn to the sport by the promise that my investment in the predecessor team to Garmin-Sharp might be the beginning of a movement to allow young cyclists to compete without the difficult choices of the generation before them. Gentlemen, let's start with our senior statesman, Scott Mercier. Scott, tell us about how you got into cycling.
I got into cycling at a relatively old age, 22. I'd graduated from UC Berkeley, and actually my dad or my stepdad said, why don't you just try bike racing for the summer? My brother was 15, and he thought it'd be a great way to spend the summer before I went off to law school or business school or whatever I was going to do. And I had pretty good success, so initially I was going to travel the world for 2 years with a backpack. And I thought, shoot, let's give this a try. So I came back in 1991 and got a job as a busboy in L.A. and gave it a go.
And I think the greatest story is it was basically from the first time you rode a cycling race to to being on the U.S. Olympic team was 18 months?
15 months.
15. Wow. Thanks for the correction. Lance, how did you, what were your, I remember you were a triathlete at the beginning, but what were your early days in cycling and when did you know that you loved the sport and wanted to be part of it?
Well, I got to the sport through triathlon, and I really got to triathlon from swimming. I started out as an age group swimmer as a kid and saw an ad for a kids triathlon, which meant obviously I had to try to get a bike, so I somehow arranged a bike. And from that point on, I quickly realized, you know, just staring at the black line all day long in a pool is not nearly as fun and liberating as riding a bike, and that was sort of history for me, and I think in the late 80s it was that I was invited up to the Olympic Training Center and invited to a couple of camps and then went on to the Junior World Championships, and really, you know, from that point on I never looked back. I always had this dream of being an Olympian. Mm-hmm. Triathlon was not yet an Olympic sport and didn't become one until 2000, and so I made the switch in the early 90s. And then went to the games in 92.
Yeah, let me quickly ask, the two of you got to both walk in to represent your country to the games in Barcelona. How did that feel like, Scott?
Well, I don't know. We didn't get to do I wasn't the team time trial, and our event was the day one. So I didn't get to walk in the opening ceremonies. I don't remember, Lance, did you get to walk in the ceremonies?
I did. Yeah, I did. That was the only time I did it. It's funny to hear Scott say that because it's, you know, our sport is, especially an event like the team time trial, which was, you know, many would consider one of the hardest disciplines. They no longer have it in the Olympics, but at the time, I mean, it's literally just 2 hours of hell. And so, Scott had to stay at home and keep his feet up.
Ian, when you tell us about how you got your start in cycling.
Yeah, so I grew up in the mountains here in Colorado, and I grew up as a ski racer, and my goal was always to ski for the University of Colorado Boulder. And I guess fortunately, but unfortunately, when I was 17, 18, I wasn't quite fast enough to make that dream come true. And, you know, I started riding a bike as cross training for ski racing and immediately found a little bit more success in the sport of cycling than I was finding as a ski racer. And I moved down to the Front Range of Colorado and started school at the Colorado School of Mines and just with the cycling scene that exists in the Front Range of Colorado, it was sort of an easy step to make. Mm-hmm. And I was really lucky that there were so many opportunities here and very quickly found my way onto a team that was run and sponsored by TIA Cref here in town and run by Jonathan Vodders. And that was that, off and running.
So I think one of the things that normal viewer doesn't understand is that you really know early in a cyclist's career that talent matters. What they do and the way they measure, all of those things, like Scott, to be 22 and 18 months or 15 months later, excuse me, be on the Olympic team, it's a sign that you have to be gifted by God with the assets that are necessary to ride. I do think that I'm going to disappoint in this show the cycling press and others because I don't want to dwell a long time on performance enhancement in that history, but I do want to talk about it at the beginning. Because it's something that each of you faced in a way with what you did. Lance, when you're just getting started, When did you first recognize that that was something that was going to be part of the scene that you were invested in?
Well, I mean, I think we all knew the history of the sport. I mean, if you go back, I mean, gosh, you can go back 70, 80, 100 years ago, and in every sort of decade or every generation, there was something, and that's just, I mean, 100 years ago, they called cyclists the convicts of the road. I mean, it was a rough and tough sport. The Tour de France was created as a gimmick to promote a newspaper. It was five stages. We think it's hard today. It's 200 kilometers a day. Back then, it was 500 or 600 kilometers, which is 350 miles a day. I mean, these guys were hanging on cars, jumping in trains, taking anything they could. And so, you know, we all knew that history. And I mean, I think, and I, you know, even when we were young guys in the early 90s, running up through the amateur ranks and before we turned pro, I mean, of course, you always want science to be a step ahead of where doping would be. And if that's the case, then everybody says, okay, I mean, science is there and we can't get around that. And so let's just lace up and race clean. But at that time, and Scott's, you know, very familiar with this period, science was way, way behind.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You had a substance in EPO that was a couple of things. One, it was tremendously helpful, tremendously beneficial to the tune of 10%. And two, and most importantly, completely undetectable.
Yeah.
Completely undetectable. And so it ran like wildfire through the peloton, and it just was what it was. And I mean, as long as Scott had the courage to tap out and say, you know what, I'm going to go back and I'm going to rely on the education that I've got, and I'm going to make a different choice. And, you know, my life and my situation was quite frankly just different. I mean, I didn't have that to rely on, and we all looked at each other and we thought, you know what, screw this. We're going to dig in and play the game. It's the way it's being played and fight. And so, you know, it's been dissected a million times over in a million different ways, and it wasn't pretty. I'm not proud of it, but it was what it was.
Let me ask Scott. I mean, Scott and Ian had different places where they went. Let me ask Scott to talk about, you know, I know Scott and his family pretty well and your history in South Africa. Talk a little bit about how you did make the decisions. Then I want to go back a little bit and ask Lance and Ian and you to sort of teach the audience about some of the things we should look for and how we build to a different place next time.
Well, I think it's important to keep perspective and context in mind. You know, Lance mentioned I had other options, and I chose to pursue those options. I'm glad that I did that, but I'll always wonder. I mean, ironically, I think Lance has paid probably, I mean, he was the greatest athlete of our generation, no question asked, doping or no doping. I think that most people will acknowledge that. He had huge success, and he's now suffering as much, if not more, than anyone. I think you could argue that I also suffered as much as anyone by not ever knowing what my potential was. Lance mentioned EPO as a game changer of 10%. The one year I did the Worlds, so I was 3% off winning the World Championships clean. So, you know, there's a price that we've all paid. It's I'm proud to consider Lance a friend today. We ride together and we're fat old guys. We get the GOP convention. We're old, fat, white guys.
For those of you watching, by the way, you know that neither of them is fat. The guy from Rocky Mountain PBS is the only one that has body fat above 3% here. So let's ask Ian your history. Then I want to get back and talk about some things that revolved around. How did you make the decisions that you had?
Well, I think there's a very important distinction here. Uh-huh. And it's very important that everyone understands that I didn't make a choice. I can't stand here and say that I made a conscious decision not to take performance-enhancing drugs, because the reality of my situation was the first year I raced as a professional was in 2005. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough to be supported by a group of people and by a sponsor who were trying to change what the mainstream didn't yet understand. But this core group of people from professional cycling knew that it was a problem and knew that it was a very difficult choice that many young cyclists were facing. And the truth be told is I was insulated from that. There are a lot of people, from Doug Ellis to Steve Goldstein to Jonathan Vaders to Alan Lim, who protected and insulated a young group of cyclists and I think enabled us to avoid that choice. I know for myself personally that it was never even an option. And we're not talking about, you know, 2012. We're talking about 2005, 2006. And I think that in hindsight, that was unbelievably powerful. Mm-hmm. And I owe a huge debt of gratitude to all of those people for protecting me from something that I truthfully didn't even know existed.
And I don't want to be disingenuous, because I was one of the original financial supporters, and Ian knows that. And thank you for not subjecting me to conflict. I do have a conflict in the sense that that was one of the things that we were trying to get accomplished. I do want to talk about, so Ian has a support group. Lance, I don't know, you know, let's say 23 to 27. Where were the adult role models in your life at the time? And were you relying on anybody for counsel that, in retrospect, you're disappointed by? Or did you just make competitive decisions on your own that led you to the decision to do that?
Yeah, I mean, it was, one thing I think is strikes me all the time is we really lost context of time here. And while Ian was talking about 05 and 06, and, mm-hmm. and I agree with all of that, although I think, not all of it, but most of it. I mean, there was a lot going on in cycling scientifically at the time. The biological passport was becoming more and more effective. Guys were also realizing, you know what, we are not going to get away with this. Yeah. But, you know, reverse it back 20 years ago. I mean, our decision that we were faced with, which we're all talking about here, was literally 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it was a long, long time ago. And so we never thought that we would be in this place, and it was moving at such a fast pace for our own lives that we just jumped in. And but the unfortunate thing is that, you know, the events of the last couple of years have really led the public to believe that this was an issue for Lance Armstrong a year ago or 2 years ago, or Lance Armstrong was doing a transfusion 2 years ago, where the you know, a kid like Ian or, even a kid like Chris Froome is a favorite to win the Tour de France. Now all he's going to do is answer questions about Lance Armstrong and doping and blood doping, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he's going to be questioned about his performances. He's going to be questioned about the answers he gives or whatever TUE he might have, a therapeutic use. So we've lost.
What's a TUE? Thank you for saying that, because it was like.
Yeah, a TUE is a therapeutic use exemption. So whatever you're allowed to, you know, if it was cortisone for a tendonitis or an inhaler for asthma, those things you can declare, and technically you can supposedly use them.
From an ethical perspective, Scott, I mean, when you're making this decision, you know, you literally had a program, you're in South Africa, you're making a decision what you do and how it affects your career, and you never really, you finished the season but never rode after that. Did your 50-year-old self talk to your 25-year-old self at the time? I mean, did you think about that?
I don't know if my 50, I mean, I'm almost 50 now, so. But I it goes back to perspective that I did have other options. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see how it was going to end well for me. And Lance said something earlier where I had the courage to leave. I still feel it was a weak decision because, I mean, I know it was built out of strength, but the doping at that time was institutionalized. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was doping on U.S. Postal Service in 1997. Lance Armstrong was not on that team. There was doping mm-hmm. in the Peloton. But so I didn't look at it as cheating per se. It was against the rules, but like Lance said, there was no test for it. You couldn't catch the EPO. It made a massive difference in performance. But there was no getting around that you were going to be a liar. And I didn't see how that would end well for me. And I just decided I didn't want to go down that road. And I thought that, okay, you start making real money. You start getting this addiction to the power. And when I say power, I mean just when you reach a zone, and Ian and Lance know what I'm talking about. When you get so fit, you're suffering, but you feel so good.
Yeah, yeah.
It's addictive.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how I'd be able to stop. Mm-hmm. So I thought I made an extreme decision that I was just going to, I spoke with Mark Gorski. They wanted me back on the team, and I just made a decision that I was going to move on.
I want to transfer a little bit to the transition to the future of cycling. Lance, obviously, I think 20 years ago, you couldn't have expected the tail of what you did to be so long. And cyclists or runners or whoever had gotten away with performance enhancement, had been competitors against others, both on the field or on the road and in the laboratory, they didn't expect to have that go back to them. Do you think it's healthy that there's this retrospective look at what riders did, what runners did and others did, that then will inhibit a future benefit over time? Is the loss of reputation that you've suffered ultimately to the benefit of the sport because others will think twice about it?
It's a great question, and it's one I ask myself every day, and it's one that I'm sure many other people ask. You know, my answer is not a popular answer, and my answer is that it wasn't worth it for our sport to be allowed to go through this process. I mean, I can't imagine, and I follow sports. I read about sports. I watch sports. I can't imagine any other professional sport allowing an outside agency to go back 15 years and dig up a lot of stuff and subject owners and athletes and union members and sponsors to what the sport has been subjected to. Now, I see your point, and I see that, you know, a young kid like Ian or you know, somebody in Peoria saying, oh, my God, well, here, I'm faced with this choice, but look what they did to Lance Armstrong. I can never make that decision. Mm-hmm. I don't know that. Of course, we can't put ourselves in that kid's mind or in his place, but I can look at what it's done to our sport. I can look at how teams and sponsors are fleeing, events are folding, participation is down, and then I can take it even further out. I can look at what it's done to Livestrong. I can look at what it's done to the top line and the bottom line there. I can look at what it's done to the amount of people that will not be served because of all this. And again, it all stems from the choices I made. But this was not, with all due respect, this was not an effort to clean up cycling. Because in order to do that, you have to truly take a global view and a global look at this thing, and a global commission has to do it, which I think we've started to do now.
Let me ask Ian a quick question. I mean, both you and Scott are parents today. Ian, I hope I can.
Yeah.
Hopefully the grandparents know this, that Ian's wife is expecting. Talk to about it from a perspective of a parent. How would you advise a child moving forward as to what they do? And I think that, to me, Lance, in a way, what moved me is the connection you had with your own kids, and it seemed to have an impact on the way you move forward with it. And so I want Ian to weigh in on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not yet a father, so I think it's hard for me to really put myself in that place. But I know that for myself and for my parents looking at me, I think that The main thing to speak to is kind of the opportunities that Scott has thought to for himself, that there were other options. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that's really profound and really important to keep in mind, that I don't know. I don't blame any professional cyclists in the past for having taken drugs. I think that they were competing in the world that they were in. And I don't think that it does any good for this sport to take a victory away from somebody in any race, because you know, going back 15 years ago, it's not that second place was clean or third place or anything
and I am from PBS, so my responsibility is to stand firmly and say I disagree with that.
Yeah.
I think that in the long run, we have to figure out how to get clean, because I think that this is a beautiful sport, and the suffering. Each one of us, me less than you guys, but I know what suffering is because I'm 200 pounds going up Independence Pass, and you guys are 120 each. You do suffer in the sport, and I like the idea that suffering is honored by that it's a product of character and talent, and I think that we have to always be aware of that, the purity of the manifestation of God-given talent. And I would say this about Scott. I've seen Scott's numbers. I've ridden with Scott. He's the greatest pro I've ever ridden with, and I've ridden with a lot of pros. Lance, you and I have never ridden. But I know you're the most talented rider of your generation. Had everything been clean, my suspicion is that the glory that would have come to you through sport would have been the same. And I think that's the thing that I talk about. I do want to go to next acts in life, because I think that each of you, in your own way, Scott and Ian, have this really impressive careers going on. I think that, Lance, we'll all be curious to hear what avenues you want to take. So, Ian, let's start with you. Tell us what you're doing now and what directions you think that's going to take.
Yeah, absolutely. So I stepped away from the sport of cycling in 2010. I had a vascular problem in my left leg that basically caused a blood flow issue and essentially pushed me out of the sport. But since then, I finished my mechanical engineering degree from the School of Mines and have helped start and am currently the CEO of a company called Scratch Labs. We're based in Boulder, Colorado. And our main aim is to give people the products and education to take better care of themselves and their families.
And I shouldn't say this, but I use the product and appreciate it a lot. It's a great product. So, Scott, talk to us a little bit about what you're doing, how your life has evolved, and the things that make you proud today.
Well, I think what makes me proud today is my family. Sometimes I fall off the wagon and get a little too selfish. That's probably, as a professional athlete, you do have to be pretty selfish. But, you know, what's next for me in cycling is I work with the Colorado Mesa University cycling team. They've won a couple of Division II titles, and I think it gets back to I encourage these kids to get their degrees, because the worst thing that's going to happen then is they have options, right? Lance talked about options. I talked about options. You talked about options, Ian. And I think that really what's next for me is just to try to continue supporting. Cycling's not really part of my life. You know, I have a business, and but just to try to help build the grassroots at the collegiate level, because I think it can be a nice feeder for the long-term perspective of the sport. I mean, you get some guys from Harvard that have been into it and they have a lot of money, 10 years, or they start a business, and they might have good memories of their collegiate cycling days. So the next step for me is just to continue to live my life, ride my bike for fun, and try to be a good friend and husband and dad.
Lance, I think, go ahead.
I would add to that, you know, one of the things that I am very proud of my sporting life, both as an amateur ski racer four or five year professional cycling career, is simply the lessons that you learn through sport. And I think that those lessons, I've found them immensely valuable in my everyday life, both personal and business. And I think that that's something that I will never forget, and that I appreciate the utmost amount from cycling.
Yeah, I think of you and Timmy Duggan. I see the friendship, and I think it's a wonderful, you know, friendship to see. Lance, as you look at your next act, obviously a period of incredible turbulence and personal reflection, what are the things that you want to do prospectively in the next phase? You're a young man. You've got a 30-year arc of your professional career. What do you see you investing your time doing?
You know, for me, it's complicated. I don't have an answer. I mean, other than to say that I have five amazing, healthy kids that are doing great and plugging along. I've got a great personal situation with Anna. It's no secret, as is widely reported almost daily, that I'm still involved with significant amount of litigation that I've just got to navigate through. It's also no secret that regardless of what happened on or off a bike, I am a cancer survivor, and that is, outside of my children, the most important thing in my life. I'm proud of what I started at Livestrong. I'm proud of all the great work that's been done there for 16 years, and it's quite frankly a bummer not to be involved anymore, but it is what it is, and I'll just keep, you know, you don't have to raise another $500 million. I can go out and just try to help people on a one-on-one basis, and you know what? I get a lot of fulfillment from that, and so I'll just keep doing that. And ultimately, the answer to your question doesn't lie with what I want to do. The answer lies with what the world will let me do.
Lance, so, let me ask about that, because I think that I know your friendship with Scott. I think that you're, whether it's a Twitter joke or it's true, you're going to write the foreword to M. O'Reilly's book. Is that correct, or is that just a Twitter?
No. That's actually already been done. So that's her book comes out July 3rd. So.
As we close this, talk to me about friendship. What has surprised you about friendships lost? What has surprised you about forgiveness given as you've gone through this?
Yeah, I've learned a lot there. I mean, in times like this, just like anybody that goes through a difficult time, it could be a divorce, it could be losing a job, whatever it could be. I mean, it could be my situation. You really learn who your friends are, and at times like that, people lean in or they lean out, and I've seen both. And you look around, you take inventory, you take stock. I mean, I see a guy like Scott Mercier, who I never thought would be a guy that would lean in, and it says a lot about him. It says a lot about his character. And then in terms of the forgiveness part, that's a complicated concept for a lot of people, and some will never give it. Some will never even look at it. And I can't fault them. I can't force them. I can't pressure them, and I can't get away from that. So all I can do is sort of live my life the way that I feel is right and fair now, and hopefully, you know, things stabilize, and ultimately I have a place in society.
When I rode up Mont Ventoux one time with Kevin Livingston, he came next to me, and I had met him one other time and had a great talk, and we talked about you, and it was after you'd not been there, and I think he lamented some loss of friendship. Do you feel like you've become a better friend? You understand how to be a better friend now? Is that something that has been, when I watch what you do and talking to Scott and others, it does seem you make a great effort at it. Is that something that has grown to you?
I think so. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say that living a simple life makes it easier to be a good friend. I mean, my life for 15 years was at warp speed. I mean, and there were, you know, personal interactions, personal relationships, the way you just, the time you could offer to friends or to family or to anybody on the street was just limited. And I probably didn't handle it well. I was probably an ass about it. But, you know, my life today is pretty simple and pretty basic, and you can kind of look around and go, okay, here's what I'm going to do this morning. I'm going to wake up, and I'm going to drive to Carbondale, and I'm gonna go put the hurt on Scott Mercier, and I'm going to come back, and that's my day. Okay. And I sort of...
Well, I always hate this part of Colorado Quarterly because I have to wrap up. Anna is a friend of friends of mine, and say hello to her and wish her the best. That's all the time we have tonight for Colorado Quarterly. Many thanks to Scott Mercier, Ian McGregor, and Lance Armstrong. Thank you for tuning in to Rocky Mountain PBS this evening, and especially for supporting us as a member as our fiscal year ends. I'm CEO Doug Price. Good night.